mostly in the 1 to 4 unit space. We can go up to 8 units for that 30-year program. And then for our short-term loans, you know, we have funded multifamily properties, but I guess the difference between like a single family loan and a multifamily or commercial project is usually the LTV.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Sean Pan is a real estate investor and hard money lender based in the San Francisco Bay Area and invests in single family renovations as well as out-of-state investments in Jacksonville, Florida. He is host of the Everything Real Estate Investing Show, where he interviews top investors and professionals. He also hosts local meetups in the South Bay Area, produces real estate-related videos, and consistently reports on local real estate news. Sean, welcome to the show.
Sam, thank you so much for having me on your podcast today.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. It's always a little intimidating to interview other podcast hosts because you feel like you're going to get judged on the quality of the show. But I'm looking forward to hopping in today. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you briefly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah. So I started real estate investing for 5 years now. Before that, I was in a completely different field. I was an engineer. I went to school at UCLA to study electrical engineering. And I was working as an engineer for a defense contractor for a good 7 years or so before finally transitioning into real estate investing. You know, during that time as an engineer, during college, I thought it was going to be like my dream job. I worked there until I retire at 65. But very quickly, I realized that this is not where I wanted to be. I have coworkers who are not really the happiest people in the world, and they had a lot of regrets on not taking all these chances when they were younger. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to fall into that trap. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, start my own business, and that's how I got into real estate investing. So long story short, I got into buying some single family homes out of state. I house hacked my own property here in the Bay Area. Eventually started flipping homes here. And then now I transitioned careers. You know, I left the full-time W-2 job to do real estate investing. But then because I had a podcast, YouTube channel, and meetup group, I ended up becoming a hard money lender so that I could, you know, help my community fund their deals.
And is that where you took the business next? You said, all right, you know what, we're going to stop being an active flipper, an active investor, and we're just going to go to the hard money side of things?
It's kind of like a parallel process. You know, we're doing content creation like the podcast and YouTube videos. And so that very easily can convert into just the lending side of the business. But at the same time, I'm still investing myself. So between my fiance and I, we have around 23 units across the country. We are, you know, semi-flipping homes, but we're not really, you know, doing too much volume at the time. Maybe one or two houses a year. But maybe in the future, we'll scale that up into a bigger process.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. So you have 23 at this point, 23 single family homes, but your primary focus is hard money lending.
Yeah. So it's 23 units. So it's combined between, you know, one unit, four units, et cetera.
Right, right, right. That's really interesting, you know, especially doing it across the country. You know, let's talk about that for a second. What have been some of those things that have given you the confidence to invest out of state?
Well, I'm going to tell you the real reason is that it's not really viable to do long-term rentals here in the Bay Area. Mm. So as an example, I'm sure all of your listeners know about the 1% rule, which is where you expect your rents to be 1% of the purchase price. So for, you know, $100,000 property, you can realistically find a property that can rent for $1,000 a month.
Sure.
Here in the Bay Area, a starter home will go for $1 million.
Right.
And it's very unlikely that you're going to find these properties renting for $10,000 a month. It just doesn't happen. You're probably renting them for $3,000 to $4,000. So right there, you're already going to be cash flow negative. Right. And on top of that, not a lot of people can just buy multiple $1 million homes and scale that quickly. So it's obviously a lot easier to go out of state, you know, leverage our Bay Area wages and buy more properties out of state.
Right, right. And so I know you said you transitioned from a W-2 job to full-time in real estate. What are the things that you were doing? So maybe you just mentioned this, but you said, you know, you can buy stuff out of state and then use your jobs to leverage that. But what was that job?
You mean my W-2 job before?
Or even now. I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood there. It sounded like you were saying that you were buying out of state and that you were using your W-2 job to help fund that.
Exactly. So yeah, back then I was an engineer. I was working on satellites for a defense contracting company. Right. And so, you know, they paid pretty decent wages.
Right.
I had lowered my cost of living expenses by house hacking here. So I had a lot of extra income to then just buy more rental properties. And of course, with a bigger W-2, you can get more loans and then scale your rental portfolio that way.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I understood that that series of events. I was thinking that was what you're still doing now. And I was just curious if there was some other. So what does hard money lending look like for you then?
Yeah. So the thing of hard money lending is it's just another way to help investors scale their portfolio. So, you know, as an example, when I first started flipping houses, a fixer in the Bay Area will go for $850,000, right, which is insane for most people who are listening to this podcast.
Yes.
But when they're all fixed up, they can sell for $1.2 to $1.3 or even $1.4 million. So there's a huge spread there. But then the issue comes when you are trying to get a loan from a bank and you're trying to get another loan for $800,000 or so, but you already have a primary residence here in the Bay Area. You already have other rental properties. Your income from your job won't support that loan, even though it's a really good deal.
Right.
So then there's no other alternative to financing these deals besides using hard money loans. And so that's kind of like, I guess, what I'm here to talk about, just hard money loans in general, how they work, how they can help other investors, and how they can help you scale. You know, even if you have millions of dollars in the bank, there are big investors who still use hard money loans because they want to do multiple projects at the same time and not invest all their funds into one deal.
Right. And that's an excellent point that even on the commercial side, there are still hard money lenders. They've just tacked more zeros onto the transaction.
Yeah.
Right. Walk us through that. I mean, maybe I'm missing something here. You know, you worked for 5 years as an electrical engineer. I would think that you would, even if you were at the top end of what an electrical engineer could make, you would tap out of your own funds to invest or to be a hard money lender on. How did you continue? Because if you're buying $800,000 houses, you know, that adds up fast, right? If you're hard money lending on those. So how did you scale the hard money lending side once you were out of your own capital?
Sure. Just to be clear, first of all, it's not my personal capital that we're lending out. Okay. So I work as a hard money lender for a company called Conventus Lending. We're a hard money lender based in the Bay Area.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So really from an investor standpoint, all you really need to think of is like how much they need for the down payment, closing costs, rehab costs, and maybe 6 months of holding cost. The rest of that is financed through a lender.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Gotcha. Okay, cool. I was thinking you had launched your own hard money lending platform out of your own proceeds. And I go, there's got to be an end to that. At least for, maybe not, but for most of us, there would be an end to that supply of money.
Yeah. I mean, even on that conversation, right? Even like the big, large hard money lending companies, they don't lend out of their own personal like piggy banks, sure, right? Sure. It's always going to be they're raising funds from private investors, or maybe they're selling their funds to a secondary market, like a hedge fund or something like that. Or they have like a warehouse line of credit. So some bank also gives them a line of credit for them to make these loans out of.
Right.
No one really just uses their own account to just make all these loans. Like it's not scalable that way.
It's not scalable. And certainly, you know, I've had relationships here in the Memphis market that were only lending out of their own portfolios, but they kept that, like you said, it was an unscalable model. They kept it very, very close to the vest. There was 5 to 7 people maybe they lent money to, and then that was it.
Exactly. And those are more like the private money lending side, not so much like institutional hard money. So like, again, private money and hard money, very similar in that they will lend based on the asset and based on like they trust you as a person.
Right.
But so private money lenders are usually more flexible. You know, you want 100% financing, you want crazy terms, they can do whatever they want because it's their money.
Right.
Whereas a more institutional hard money lender, they will have usually cheaper rates and more access to capital, right? They're not going to run out of money. They can lend you 10 million, 20 million, who cares? Right. But they're going to have stricter underwriting processes versus the private money lender.
Oh gosh, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think back to the days when I was in the single family side of things, and it could literally be, hey, I would like to buy this property. Can you have money at the title company tomorrow? And they would literally just go drive, look at it, stick the money at the title company, and then I go and close. Right? There wasn't a shred of paper besides what we signed at the closing. You know,
right,
on the private money lending side, which is amazing. You know, and that speed of that money came with a price tag attached to it. But yeah, you're right. There is, and that's a differentiation I don't hear a lot of, which is different from private money and hard money. What do you see when it comes to the bigger loans, like maybe on the commercial side of things? What do you guys see happening on the hard money lending space? How's it being used? What's that look like as a whole?
Yeah, so for our firm, we typically deal in like the 1 to 4 unit space, mostly for fix and flip loans. We also do have a 30-year long-term rental loan program. Again, mostly in the 1 to 4 unit space. We can go up to 8 units for that 30-year program. And then for our short-term loans, you know, we have funded multifamily properties, but I guess the difference between like a single family loan and a multifamily or commercial project is usually the LTV. So for a single family property, if you're really experienced, we can go up to 90% of purchase and like 100% of the rehab budget. Right. Whereas for a multifamily commercial building, usually the LTV drops to like 70%.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Walk us through then, I guess, you know, some of the things maybe that people should be looking out for when it comes to hard money lending. Talk to us about some of the mechanics of it, you know, how to set expectations, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say if you're just getting started, the first thing to do is obviously call as many people as you can, because the more people that you talk to, the more you kind of understand what are the current rates, what are appropriate timelines and different, you know, service points. So, I mean, when talking to a hard money lender, you really want to make sure that one, like they're reputable so that if they tell you that this is your rate, by the time you get to the closing table, it's still the same rate, right? Sometimes they'll tell you like a really small, like teaser rate and come to the closing table. Oh, sorry, things have changed. We're going to increase your fees. We're going to increase your rate. Another thing too is also understand like where their servicing fees are going towards, right? So often lenders will add extra fees on top of, you know, the regular rates and points. And the third, of course, is the time frame. Like how fast can they close? And do they usually close on time or do they usually delay? So these are just questions you should ask. And I think the best thing to do is maybe talk to other investors in your network and see if you've ever worked with this particular lender before. Because if it is some no-name lender who's offering you these amazing terms, yeah, who knows? Like maybe maybe it's real or maybe it's not, but you really don't know.
You don't know. You don't know. And those are great points, because I've certainly seen that you know, before, where you get the teaser rate, you get something, and then you get to the finish line, you go, wait, the fees are twice what you had sent me as a term sheet, you know, a month ago. This is madness. The timeline was one of the things that I can only imagine for you guys being able to truncate that timeline. Cause a lot of times when you're dealing with a seller, how fast you can close is almost as important as, you know, how much you're paying them. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's why people often write that they're using cash to buy this property. In the notes, they say we have the right to use hard money loans at no impact to the timeline. I mean, that's the beauty of the hard money loan. For our company, we still do a walkthrough, like BPO, which stands for a broker's price opinion, right, in lieu of a full appraisal. Hmm. So, but by doing that, it really shortens the time frame of being able to just generate the loan. For us and for most lenders, it takes us around 10 to 14 days to close on a deal, which is a lot faster than conventional financing at, you know, 25, 30 plus days.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, if you guys are going straight BPOs and skipping the formal appraisal, you know, you're saving on some fees on the front end. I would imagine you're getting a fairly close number to what appraisals are coming in at anyway, no?
Exactly. I mean, and that's also a reference point, right? We also have our own back-end underwriters who are also looking at the deal too, just to make sure that the numbers align.
That's really interesting. What are some things, I know you gave us some quick pointers there on fees, timeline, things like that, but what are some things you see that are maybe not advantageous to using hard money?
Well, obviously, if you're buying at like the peak of the market and you're paying over asking price for this property because you really want to get a deal, and then the market turns on you, you know, and then you have to hold on to the property while paying these relatively high interest rates, it's going to hurt. So hard money loans typically range between, you know, 8% and 10% for the note rate.
Right.
So, you know, make numbers easy, I guess, for a $500,000 loan amount at 10%, you're paying $50,000 in interest costs alone.
Right.
Right. So if you're holding on to that property for a year, 2 years, it's going to hurt. And not to mention, a lot of these hard money loans usually only have a 12-month timeline anyway. Mm-hmm. So when you're at month 11 and you haven't sold yet, your lender is going to call you and say, hey, what are your plans? Are you going to sell the property at a loss? Are you going to refinance? Are you going to extend your loan? Refinancing and extending your loans are definitely viable options. Lenders don't really want to foreclose on you in general,
right,
but it's going to cost you, right? You're going to pay an extra 1% of the loan amount to refinance or extend your loan. So that's another $5,000 right there for your $500,000 loan. And that's painful, especially when you're holding onto a property and paying this monthly interest. Yeah, it hurts.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What do you think your company's plan is? Cause I mean, while there's the risk on the borrower side, right? Say the market turns on you, there's also risk on the lender side. You know, if a market turns and suddenly you guys have to take back a slew of loans, like what is their risk mitigation strategy in that event?
Lower LTV. That's like the lender's biggest protection against going out of business is giving lower LTV loans. So I think that's honestly what our like company is trying to do. They prefer to give newer investors a lower LTV loan, but then price it really well. So again, as an example, when I was first getting started in the business, most lenders are offering hard money loans at 10% and 2 points. My firm, we generally offer 8.5% and 1 point for our loans. So we're very competitive. But we generally want to see like 80% LTV or lower loans for newer investors. Mm-hmm. Whereas some other firms would be totally okay doing 90% for the purchase price and 100% for the rehab cost. But you can see when you're super leveraged like that, if that borrower defaults, then the company has to spend extra money to foreclose on the property, get it back. And then they have to spend the money to rehab it and then put it back on the market. So during COVID, last year in March, a lot of hard money lending companies actually went out of business because they had to claw back all these different properties when all their borrowers stopped paying their mortgages. Our firm, we stayed alive, right? So we're pretty proud that we managed to do really well. And when things opened up in like June or July of last year, we were, you know, on the ground running and we didn't get impacted that badly from COVID.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a comment about, you know, the markets last March, April that I hadn't heard yet was on the hard money lending side of things. And you're telling me that there were some shops that just ended up folding because of that. I hadn't heard that story or those stories yet.
Yeah, I have a lot of coworkers who came from these branches. So we're glad to have them there because we also got to share knowledge of how other firms were working. And yeah, I mean, I've heard some horror stories too, where some like lending companies were like bitter about losing their businesses that they decided to just put like notice of defaults on their clients just to say, screw you guys, because they're going out of business anyway. Instead of like working with them to like figure something out.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Legal notice of default won't stick.
But it's on their record now, you know?
They went ahead and put it out there and said, you deal with it. You know,
pretty much.
You get this cleared up. You know, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care if we have the legal right to do this or not. We're doing it and you fix it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's wild. That is wild. Talk to us about your real estate investing show, the Everything Real Estate Investing Show. What's that about? Why did you launch it? Give us kind of the background on that.
Yeah. So I created my podcast, Everything Real Estate Investing Show, almost three years ago now. So it was like late 2018. Basically, I had come out of some really big wins from my own like flipping experiences. But the thing is, which is really strange, is I didn't feel good about making all those wins. I made a lot of money, but I didn't feel fulfilled in any way because the only one who really benefited was me, right? Like the seller didn't win. My real estate agent got his cut, but he didn't really make a huge profit. I was the one who made a lot of money. So I wanted a way to share knowledge, right? To feel more fulfilled. And that's honestly why I started the podcast in the beginning. Now, down the line, I realized, wow, with this platform here, I can invite amazing guests such as yourself to come on the show and basically have you give me 1 hour of free consulting, right? I get an hour of knowledge with some of the best and brightest people in my space. Whereas before at like meetup groups and whatnot, we have a great speaker come up and I would feel too shy to approach them and ask them for an hour of their time. I feel like what value am I giving him? Right. Like he doesn't need me to buy him lunch, right? But if I can give him a platform to then have them talk about whatever they want to talk about for an hour, I can get free consulting. I can increase my network by meeting these big players. And of course I can share the information with the world. So it's been an amazing experience. My podcast has been going on for 3 years now and we release an episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m. on the dot. So I haven't missed a week yet.
Good for you, man. And that's, podcast fade is a real thing, right? Which is where people launch a podcast and, you know, I don't know what the stat is, but it's, you know, getting past episode 20 is not very high. So good for you, you know, three years in on that. That's absolutely fantastic. Now, are you still hosting a meetup there in San Francisco?
Yeah. So we're about an hour south of San Francisco. It's in like San Jose. Now, we used to host them live like twice a month. Of course, with the pandemic, I decided to stop hosting live events, but we do host online events all the time where I have either a guest speaker come on to talk about, you know, their subject matter expertise, or I just have a, you know, basic networking group to like simulate the bar experience where I have all these different people and we break them out into small breakout rooms of like four or five people. So they get to connect. And every 20 minutes, we break out and we switch the rooms. So doing that has been pretty fun. So we've been doing this virtually for about a year now, and it's way easier doing it online versus in person because I don't have to coordinate physical locations. I don't have to drive anywhere. I just set up the camera and we're good to go.
Right. Yeah. And I bet that's been able to really grow your audience as well, you know, where you're no longer limited to the people that are within physical distance of wherever the meeting is being held.
I've had people come from India, from England. It's kind of wild, right? I mean, they're usually expats, right? And they just happen to be bored at nighttime. So they're hanging out at our meetups.
Right. Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic. Man, that's been super cool. I've enjoyed learning, you know, about the hard money lending side of things. How does hard money lending, like how does that differ? We'll go back to this real quick because there's a couple more questions I have on this. And then we'll start wrapping this up. But how does hard money lending, say, compare to a commercial bridge loan? You know, a lot of these, what we're seeing a lot on the commercial side of things, especially for your larger acquisitions, you know, $10 to $30 million, kind of the perfect window for bridge lending because, you know, people need to get deals done fast and bridge can fill that gap. How does it differ in that regard?
You know, honestly, it's hard to say the pros and cons because I'm not super familiar with bridge financing on the commercial side. Because I hear different things all the time, right? Sometimes I hear you can get a bridge loan for a big commercial property for like 4% or something like that. Mm. I don't know. I've heard, right? Yeah. I've heard. So for us, you know, I'm really an expert on like the single family to four unit side, right? So in general, our loans are going to be 12-month interest-only loans at 8.5% to 10%. That's usually like the realm of reality. Credit scores, you know, usually a hard money lender will want to see above a 600 or so just because, again, they're not really looking at you, but they still are looking at you. They want to make sure that you're not accused of fraud in the past, that you're somewhat responsible with paying your lenders in the past. So, I mean, based on that information, how do you think that differs from commercial financing? Maybe we can go back and forth real quick.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, on the bridge side, you know, you're typically going to have a 3-year IO period, maybe with 1-year extensions possible. You are going to be paying. I've not seen it in the fours. That seems ridiculously low. You're still going to be paying in the sixes. You know, right now, we just closed a deal with some bridge financing and it was in the sixes. You know, no prepayment penalties. And the other cool thing about bridge is right now you can, a lot of times get the lender to loan on the after repair value. So say, you know, we haven't done repairs yet, but they'll say, okay, well, we'll loan up to, let's say you're going to do $1 million in repairs and you're buying a $10 million property. Okay. We'll base this. And again, this is just made up numbers. We'll base it on $11 million. As the value of the property. So you can kind of increase your leverage there, which again, going back to your comment earlier, was you increase risk, right? Both risk to the lender and use to the borrower. But you know, there's sometimes in places for stuff like that. So I don't know that it's dramatically different in the sense that you guys are doing 90% plus 100% of the rehab cost. You can get a lot of that worked into to bridge as well. So maybe not that dramatically different, but it is certainly interesting. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, one of the things that people are running into is the long-term rentals. You know, you may get to a point where you can no longer, that you're taking down deals, maybe you're done flipping, you're adding rentals to your portfolio, maybe it's fourplexes, whatever it is, but you now need a long-term way to finance those. Do you guys participate in that space?
Exactly. So that's kind of another reason why I wanted to come on the show to talk about it, because these long-term rental loans are relatively new. I mean, for us, we've only been doing them for about a year or so now.
Okay.
I guess to give your audience some context, if you're in the single family or small multifamily space, you can get a conventional loan pretty easily up to your first four loans. Right. Then it gets a little bit harder on 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But after 10, the banks would just cut you off. Like right. You just can't get a conventional loan after your 10th loan. Another thing too is they're going to be basing these loans on your debt to income ratio. So they're going to look at all of the like principal, interest, taxes, insurance payments for all the properties you own. If you have any like student debt or minimum card payments or whatever you have, they'll take all that number and put it as like a debt figure and then divide it by your income. So your job income from your W-2 or, you know, business income if you own the business for over 2 years, or rental properties at a certain percentage, like 75% of that rental income. But let's say you don't have a W-2, you're a full-time real estate investor or you're self-employed, right? A lot of people have debt to income issues.
Right.
Or maybe you have just too many properties, right? Like what if you have 2 Bay Area properties? You're done, right? You just can't get more rental properties. So that's when this program would work for you because we qualify the loan based on the debt service coverage ratio of the individual property instead of on your own debt to income ratio. So basically it allows you to scale because again, we don't care how many loans you have. We only care if the property can sustain itself.
Right.
And our rates aren't too bad either. Like our rates start at 4%. So when an investment loan right now can be for like 3.5, 4% isn't too bad considering you don't use your own debt to income ratio.
Right. And when you're looking at that 4%, I mean, the key question on a lot of these programs is, you know, what type of fees are involved in that? Because I've seen just on some tear sheets, some really exorbitant fees that just go, gosh, this makes this lending program almost unworkable. How do you guys get around that?
So typically for our loans, we charge 1 point for the origination fee. I know I charge around $9.99 for processing. And then of course you have to pay for appraisals. And sometimes in some states, there's also a legal fee attached to it as well. And that really depends if, you know, it's like an attorney closed state, like in the East Coast, like New York and them, those are attorney closed states. California, there's no attorneys involved. So it's not an attorney closed state. Yeah. So, I mean, those are the basic fees that kind of go around. Now, another thing to note is that 4% is kind of like that dream target number that we try to get our clients to. Usually just by going on like the standard, okay, I want the bare minimum fees. I want the lowest prepayment penalty period. You're probably not going to get the 4%. You get the 4% through a combination of having a great credit score, having a lower LTV, so lower loan to value for your loan, and then also potentially buying down the rate. So like I mentioned, it's 1 point usually, but some people pay extra. And also these loans come with a prepayment penalty, usually of 3 years to start, but it can go all the way up to 7 years.
Right.
So for most people who are holding onto the properties for 30 years anyway, they don't care, right? They're going to opt in for that 7 year prepayment penalty period because they want the lowest rate possible.
Right, right. Yeah, I've seen that as well. The rate buy down feature is really an intriguing. It's essentially an insurance policy if you ever want to sell before, you know, before that time, you know, comes to when you're out of prepayment penalties. So that's really interesting, very very fascinating. And what's the typical loan length term on loans like that you guys are seeing right now?
I mean, we're doing them for 30 years. So we have different variants. So we have a 30-year fixed option, which is honestly the ones that I do. I've never seen anyone use this and then go for like a 5-1 arm or a 7-1 arm.
Right.
So it's been 30-year fixed, but we also do have like a 10-year interest only option too. So it's a 30-year fixed loan. Just your first 10 years are interest only. So that's also been a very popular option for people who want to boost their cash flow for the first 10 years.
Right. Wow. Wow. That's crazy, man. That's fantastic. I have certainly enjoyed our conversation here today, Sean. Thanks for coming on. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our listeners before we jump into the final four?
Yeah. I mean, if they want to reach out to me, they can just hit me up on Instagram at @I'm_SeanPan or through an email, Sean, S-E-A-N, @everythingrei.com. But let's go on with the final four.
Gotcha. Here we go. First question is this. If I gave you $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
You know, honestly, I was in that very same situation a couple of years ago. I had $20,000 and I wanted to invest in real estate. So I invested out of state. When you're first getting started and you have no experience, it's totally okay with just getting a regular home. It doesn't need to be a home run. You're going to learn so much from just the process of creating your team out of state, like finding your property manager, finding your agent, finding the deal, analyzing it, and then buying it and closing it and seeing the whole thing through. So that's what I would do. I would get set up and buy like a $100,000 property with that $20,000.
Right. 20,000, 20% down payment. Yeah, that's absolutely great. What did you do that completely at arm's length out of state?
I did. Yeah. I had to create my own team from scratch.
Did you ever go see the property?
Not the first three. It was only after I had a few that I flew over and met my team.
That's fantastic. Hats off to you. That's a job well done. Question number two is this. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
So back to our conversation of leverage, don't over leverage. You know, some people, if they want the max, I would say if you can afford to not take as much leverage as possible, get less, you usually get better pricing on your loans. And it's also a safer position for you in case something goes wrong.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great, great answer. Third question is this, when it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
I'm investing in content like this one, because we're able to create great, you know, great information, both for us, for our knowledge, and also to share that knowledge with the world.
Right. That's great, man. That's great. I know you've already answered this, but just so we keep them all in sequence, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
You can reach out to me at Sean@everythingrei.com. That's Sean@everythingrei.com. Also, please check out the podcast, the Everything Real Estate Investing Show, and the YouTube channel at youtube.com/SeanPanInvest.
Awesome. Sean, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Sam, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.